I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. Oysters are usually seen as a luxury now, but back in the day, they were so abundant they were an everyman food. Like in coastal cities, you could have them on the street or in dingy bars for practically nothing. But a man named Thomas Downing, in the early 1800s in New York, built an empire out of an oyster bar. And even Queen Victoria was a fan of his oysters. Now today, it's sort of a cliche to call someone the first celebrity chef. But Downing was one of America's first celebrity restaurateurs. But here's the thing. He was a black man, doing this during the era of slavery. Joanne Hippolyte is a curator at the National Museum of African American History and Culture, and she came in to tell us more of Thomas's story. Hi, Dr. Hippolyte.
Hi, Francis.
So can you tell us about Thomas Downing, who he was, and how he made his fortune in oysters?
Thomas Downing was a restaurateur. He was a caterer. He was a abolitionist. He was many things, but he's most well known, as you just mentioned here, for his oyster restaurant called Thomas Downing's Oyster House in New York City. And this was during the 19th century.
Mm. And where did he come from? How did he become an oysterman?
Thomas Downing was an African-American man. His parents were actually enslaved people who were set free by their Virginia slave masters. So he grew up a free man on Chincoteague Island, which is on the eastern shores of Virginia. So his lifestyle, his family's lifestyle, they owned property on the island, was very much, you know, clamming, digging, raking oysters, fishing. That was his everyday livelihood and his family's livelihood.
And how did he come to New York?
He ends up moving out of Virginia. He follows the troops north after the War of 1812, spends about 7 years in Philadelphia, where we understand that he was running an oyster bar. So he moves from raking oysters to actually working in an oyster bar. And then in New York, we find him stirring up in the census around 1819, and he's listed as an oysterman. Now, this was an occupation that a number of African-American men in New York held. So he's the kind of person that would have gone out on a boat or a schooner and helped harvest some of the oysters from the many beds in New York City's waters and brought them back and either sold them to the various marketplaces that then sold them to restaurants, or he peddled them on the streets. We're not exactly sure, but he's definitely harvesting them at that period of time.
Do we know how he goes from there to not only having a restaurant, but having, as I understand, an extraordinarily successful restaurant?
By the mid-1820s, we know he's opened an oyster refectory. That's what they're called at that time, or an oyster cellar. And they're called cellars because you actually go down the stairs to enter these spaces.
Oh, and cellar with a C.
Yeah, with a C. Okay. Exactly. And this is another occupation that a number of African-American had. So he wasn't the only African-American who owned an oyster cellar, but he quickly distinguished himself for having a cellar like no other. He operated two properties that were adjoined to each other on Broad Street. And so that gave him an expansive footprint. So these other oyster cellars were known as rough and tumble places with, you know, dim lights and a crowd that you were never sure if you were safe with your goods in these establishments. But Thomas Downing had, again, I said, an expansive footprint. So he had a large dining area. He had curtains and he had a fine carpet. He was known for having a chandelier in his space. So this was fine dining. And his clientele were largely white men, men of means, merchants, bankers, Wall Street officials, and newspapermen.
And so his place sort of became like the watering hole for the elite, right? It was like that was their spot.
Yeah, that's where he really distinguished himself. He owned probably the best-known oyster restaurant in New York City, owned by any white or black person at that period of time. And it was the place to be for visiting dignitaries, for travelers from different countries, for merchants, and also men of means would bring their wives there to eat.
Is that unusual at that time?
It is unusual because the place has to be respectable. That's where you get to understand that his is different from all the oyster cellars. You want to bring them to a place where ladies' sensibilities are not going to be disturbed, right?
Oh, how delicate.
Yes.
But actually, this is actually really interesting because now I think, you know, we have to put ourselves in the mindset of as you said, this was in the 1800s, right? And now I think if you think of an oyster restaurant, I think we could automatically assume it to be nice. Oysters are expensive. They're an elite food. But back then, oysters were, they could be an everyday food. They could be an everyman kind of food, right? And so for him to lavish this kind of care and attention and luxury to onto it was, it sounded unique.
Yeah, oysters were incredibly inexpensive back then. They were eaten by all classes. And so, I mean, I think that what I've read is that for 6 cents, you can get a dozen, you know? So,
oh, wow.
And that's because they were so plentiful. And so when Thomas Downing enters this market, he finds a way to distinguish himself by making it a place where the upper class, the elite, the merchant class, the people of means are looking for a sort of a sense of refinement, right? A sense of class in certain places where they dine. And that's where he finds his niche.
So he was incredibly successful. He owned the place that the elite came. And I heard somewhere that when he passed away, the Chamber of Commerce, like the New York City Chamber of Commerce, came, like all came to his funeral. Is that true?
Yeah, I heard that they closed for the day, actually, as well, for his funeral. He certainly gained a lot of social and political capital because of the clientele that he served, these men of means, these men that had connections throughout New York City. And they seem to have had quite a bit of respect for him. And when Thomas Downing got into trouble, every once in a while, I think he could pull on these connections that he had to back him up, to support him. There are these stories, for instance, of African-American oystermen who owned these ordinary cellars, more ordinary cellars. Currency during that period of time wasn't always stable. And so there were these fake levels of currency, right? Fake money that people would pay for their food with, and you could spot them. Yeah, absolutely. None of that seemed to happen at Thomas Downing's Oyster House. He knew he could get the backup of his own clientele to support him if he was calling a particular currency of a customer into question, whereas other African-American men didn't have that kind of support and often had to deal with the fact that they were being swindled.
Oh. He seemed also to be very important to different communities, that community that we just talked about, but also people fleeing enslavement. His place was a stop on the Underground Railroad, is that right?
It was. So on the one hand, here's Thomas dining with this exclusive white clientele at his restaurant, right? It's only for white diners. And on the other hand, he's this significant community figure and activist in the African-American community. He harbored refugees, slaves. Slaves on the run in the cellars themselves. And he was also well known for, after New York had abolished slavery in 1837, he helped found the Committee of 13, which was this organization that was working to protect free people from being, you know, kidnapped and being sold back into the South, actually, as we know from the story of Solomon Northrop and 12 Years of Slave.
Let me pull this back a little bit. So you're a curator in the Cultural Expressions Gallery of the museum. And Thomas Downing's story isn't the only place in your galleries where oysters appear. Why does that food hold prominence in the story of the African-American experience?
I think it helps us, and oysters help us interpret identity, interpret historical circumstances. So there are several circumstances where you see oysters showing up throughout our 13 permanent exhibitions at the National Museum of African American History and Culture. And one of them, I think, that is most poignant is in the Slavery and Freedom exhibition. There are these displays of oyster shells. And we're told through the label that these were used by children on Edisto Island in particular. So it's a waterside community, African American community, enslaved children to eat. So there's this moment when you're encountering these oyster shells and you realize the disparity visually, this visual disparity between enslaved people and free people, the fact that they would have to use these discarded, you know, remnants of things to use as utensils as opposed to the knives and forks that people with better means would have access to.
Yeah. Well, this is so interesting. Thank you so much, Dr. Hippolyte.
Thank you.
Joanne Hippolyte is a curator at the National Museum of African American History and Culture. And you can find a recipe for a classic, oyster stew, on splendidtable.org.